now we have the pleasure to have Dr. Shazaman Haque from INALCO Paris, who is going to talk about language socialization of Urdu-speaking migrants in France, invisible men's access to the clandestine labor market. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I am very much thankful to Professor Cécile Vigoureux and Professor Sally Coco Mufuvane for giving me the opportunity to participate in this wonderful workshop. So my talk is about the language practices of the Urdu-speaking asylum seekers in France from Afghanistan and Pakistan, focusing on their entry into the clandestine labor market without work permit and without language skills in French language. So now if we go for the research context, so this paper or this presentation is based on a talk, in fact, on the data which was gathered through a research project entitled Liminal, funded by the French National Research Agency and hosted by INALCO in Paris. So I was one of the members of this project as an Urdu language researcher, and the principal investigators were two anthropologists, Marie-Caroline Saglio-Yazimirsky and Alexandra Galizine-Lumpe. And other people who were involved in this research project were from other disciplinary fields, like from sociology, social communication, cultural studies, translation and language, etc. So when I entered into the field, my purpose was to assess the linguistic situation of the asylum seeker, and in particular, the Urdu-speaking ones. So how it may impact on their future settlement in the country or on ongoing mobility within Europe. So the project was centered around social, cultural, and linguistic mediations in some refugee reception centers in Paris, Calais, north of France, we can say that, Ventimiglia, French-Italian border, and suburbs of Paris. My fieldwork started in 2018 in Parisian suburbs, and I did some fieldworks in Calais. And then finally, I was more interested in a temporary asylum centers in the suburbs of Paris, like in Ivry-sur-Seine. So this study was based on suburban subjects of Paris whose struggles and mobilities, it remained invisible to the center. The invisibility is about their language practices, their sufferings and their needs, because mostly one who stays in suburbs are ignored by the national media and policymakers. The social linguistic investigation of this research was to identify the languages that can be used to assist the asylum applicants in the formal process, to identify the common lingua franca so that assistance can be provided in these languages, to identify also the degree of literacy that refugees have in home languages. And this will determine whether it was worthwhile to produce written materials in such languages or not. Another aspect of the social linguistic investigation was to establish the modes of communication and languages which refugees use to interact with other refugees, various level of authorities, and with relatives, friends, and so on. So when I entered into the fieldwork, I was looking for Pakistani national asylum seekers for the first reason that my own research was in the field of social linguistics of Urdu. Another reason was that France gives protection to Pakistanis under the Geneva Convention of 1951, but I was surprised, and it is like social linguistic of mobility, to observe that there were more Afghan Urdu-speaking asylum seekers than there were Pakistanis. So I will come on this phenomenon later. So though it has been said that 2015 was the year of migratory crisis in Europe, when 3 million refugees have arrived in Europe, the numbers have considerably slowed down since then. So here we have two latest data on the number. So Alfred Schultz, he wrote that a stranger is shaken when he discovers that the elements of his new environment turned out to be very different from what he expected when he was still at home. So the image of France is like a foreign, and foreign means English for the people of Indian subcontinent. So this is not an isolated case. It seems to be the case of almost all asylum seekers or migrants who have a positive image of English. So these basic language assumption means that British colonization in the Indian subcontinent is interpreted as English speaking and white colored colonization. Leaving for Europe means going to English speaking countries. So S planned, he planned to in fact become an entrepreneur in the household appliance sector, but he would have to go through French. However, learning French seems too difficult for him because of poor mental health like Azzy. And so there is also an uncertainty, which you also told the word uncertainty, that hangs over their future, over the future of all the asylum seekers. They are not certain if their asylum application will be approved or not. They have to invest in the language or not, you know. Now we come to the case number 5, case study of I. So I was a 52-year-old asylum seeker from Afghanistan. And he came with his wife and 6 children. And he got several temporary works in a construction site through a Pakistani network. He complained of not getting paid often by his employers. He didn't need to speak French at his workplace. Thank you. And his Urdu was correct. So he was working. He was waiting for the decisions for 2 years now. He was very frustrated. But off and on, he was working with Pakistani network without any skill in French language. And this is the case study of Ifti. I named him Ifti. And this was a person who I came to know as an asylum seeker in 2018. And in those times, I was working as an interpreter in the Home Office. And he became like a friend with me because he used to send me some documents to translate. And so Ifti, he got work also in the construction site. And he was very happy. In fact, he was very stable without any French language support. And I spoke him again a few days ago after a gap of 1.5 years for this workshop to know that what's happening with Ifti. And if he were still working in an informal economy sector. So I came to know that he got his papers made in Portugal. So he can technically live in France, but he still needs a work permit and long stay permit to stay in France. He doesn't have these papers, but he's still working, but he's working with a Moldovan national. And he speaks a little bit French, but he speaks mostly in Urdu and in Punjabi with other co-workers. So I don't have much time. And if we see some data from INSEE, a National Institute for Statistics and Economic Studies, so we can see the relation between French and first job for migrants. So what we find that during their first job in France, 85% of immigrants who arrived 15 or over, they worked as an employee or as a worker of these immigrants reported that they spoke little or no French at all during their first job. So the ease of obtaining a first job is generally not closely linked to language proficiency. Nonetheless, it appears that men who did not speak French at all when they arrived in France have less rapid access to a first job than those who speak it a little well or very well. So this is about, I think that I will leave it because it has nothing to do with my, but perhaps I may comment on later. This was about Migralect, and it is a kind of language which migrants have developed in close contacts with other migrants of other linguistic community but similar backgrounds, okay? So I will comment on later if we need. I will just go back to the conclusion. So what we see in the conclusion that the linguistic environment and landscape introduce the asylum applicants to the language regimes they will be subjected to, the endorsement of English as the global lingua franca, There was a heavy reliance of multilingual volunteers as interpreters. And finally, what we saw also that Urdu emerged as a link language among the South Asian asylum seekers, particularly among the Pakistanis, Afghans, and Bangladeshi asylum seekers. The case studies have demonstrated that there is a system of communitarian capital, which Gago explains in the case of Bolivian migration. What it does it mean that there is a deep ambivalence? It can work as a resource for self-management, accumulating experience, earning a little wage, and at the same time as a resource for servitude, submission, and exploitation. So there is an intertwining of the clandestine labor market with invisible language practices, making these asylum seekers invisible men. What we find that work precedes the language phenomenon. And there is a complete negation of the linguistic market theory advanced by Bourdieu. And finally, according to Utopia Movement, an NGO in Paris, when a foreign person arrives in a country at working age, it has cost the state nothing in terms of education and training. Similarly, when the same person happens to go back in the country of origin when he retires, healthcare is not covered at all when the need to resort is very much needed. That's all. I thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Is there any question from the audience and from the online audience as well? You can either type your question in the chat box or speak, open your mic and speak if you want to interact with the speaker.
I'll start with a comment. I'm glad you cited Bourdieu. But my understanding of Bourdieu is that the market value of a language varies from one setting to another. And so what I see here is a case of miscalculation on the part of the migrants or immigrants, not really knowing the language regime of the destination, coming from a place where English is rated very high on the scale of, in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, and being surprised that English doesn't have, well, it has some status, an important one in some jobs for which the immigrants are not qualified.
Yes, yes.
But where they can find jobs, English has no value. And this is how they wind up becoming, as you characterize them, as invisible immigrants, because they cannot wait until they get papers. They have to earn a living, and they go and work for people that find their languages useful, but there is a cost for that kind of, practical response to the local situation.
Yes. I think that it's for most of the people, even when they get the paper also, they need basic, I'm talking about the French context, and they need basic skill in the French language so that they can do some work or they can understand how the system works. But in parallel, everything is working also. Without French and without English, I was invited some 10 years ago to teach French to a group of 15 construction workers. They were all Punjabis from India, and their boss was a Pakistani. And they were all speaking among themselves in Punjabi, and that was a huge construction site, huge chantier, and gros chantier, near Airport Charles de Gaulle. And they were all happy, and they didn't want to learn French. I was just going behind them, that come learn French, and it didn't work. So I just went away after 2 days.
Yeah.
South Africa.
Alfonso has a question. Can you pass the mic? Oh, okay. No, Manuela, yes, you have the mic.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting because of the construction, of course, industry. And I have just a question about the importance of subcontractors in this. And I was wondering if the case number six, I'm sorry, I forgot the name, is the case of such a subcontractor, man, who at the beginning was just employed as a construction, you know, worker, and then maybe act as manpower entrepreneur, something like this, and that's why they are happy. And it's exactly the same case in the early 20th century the Italians. So it's striking.
No, no, they are not subcontractor. He is not a subcontractor.
He is not.
He is happy because he has a stable job. And he doesn't speak French at all. He is working with a subcontractor.
Speaking
Punjabi and Urdu.
Punjabi, exactly. So there is a man.
There is a man. The boss is the boss speaks Punjabi.
Great.
He mediates. Now his new boss is Moldovan. Moldovan nationality. And Moldovan, in fact, with him, he speaks a little bit French. He told me that now, because it has been now 6 years that he's here, IFTI. So now he speaks a little bit French, so he can understand a little bit. So he has developed this kind of competencies, but he has other co-workers who speak Urdu and Punjabi, so he's very fine with them.
Great, because this is a kind of job and then where communication is very important, because in construction sites, you have to coordinate yourself with other people in order to build a building with several, you know, tasks. Okay, so it's really interesting. Thank you.
Alfonso?
Yeah, so thanks. This is great. And, you know, while you were talking, and then I was having in mind also Leonie's talk, I do think we need to kind of maybe not fall into the trap that kind of European liberal democratic state is putting us, preparing for us as sociolinguists, right? Because I do think we should not take for granted the idea, you know, language as key to, right? But rather think more about what is the whole apparatus which the liberal state puts in place around these specific, in your case, French language classes that your informants don't need, right? Because I think that if we put the question in terms of, you know, do they really need French to get to a job, we don't come very far. I do think that the point is that in Europe, all these language classes are anchored within a liberal democratic state. That means they come with welfare. They come with a whole set of money, but also they come with visibility. That means control. Okay, so getting into these classes is not necessarily about, you know, getting the language that you need to go and get a job. Entering these classes makes you visible to the disciplinary kind of dimension of the state. That's why if they die or go back to Pakistan, they don't get anything, because they are not channeled within this kind of, you know, apparatus of control. So I do think, and I also think we need to be careful to think about, you know, these people trump the state. You know, there is this idea of legal illegalization. I mean, the state is aware of this. Right. And I do think it's there. You know, the whole system is put in place in order to produce an army of workers like this, highly exploitable people who make, you know, who earn 200 euros a month. Right. Usually, you know, I don't know. So I do think that we really need to anchor to really better understand what's happening here, to really maybe not to fall into the trap that the state is preparing for us, namely, you know, to fully normalize the idea that language is a key to work, And then you come to the conclusion, no, it's actually not, because they can use their own language. But these language classes, I think, are more complicated, are part of a much more complicated system which goes beyond the just, okay, what do they need to get a job? And I think that by kind of anchoring that, so I just realized that by listening to you guys, by anchoring that within a more complicated, I think we also get to understand what is the value of these kind of language classes, both of doing it and also not doing it. I mean, in terms of from the perspective of the person then who attends. Yeah.
I completely agree with you. I got your point. The question is also that, well, I don't think that we are against the language classes. We cannot be against the language classes, but we see that it has very less utility. Perhaps it's not delivering the kind of thing which it should have delivered. The language classes which I have observed over there in this camp, there were around 15 to 20 people who used to come every day. But some of them were interested and others were not interested. This brother, he was not interested. He told me that nothing enters into my brain. And this was the line which was told by many refugees, many asylum seekers, and perhaps perhaps in other countries also. So I do agree that language is not the tool for the stepping stone, and we have to see what kind of other tools which we can employ to give them more stability. It is a very complex issue, but we cannot also deny that language classes should not be given, you know.
Can you speak on the mic because people cannot hear you online? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so maybe it's just my own kind of... I think that when you say language are maybe not so... they don't consider them so useful, these language classes. So at this point, I'm actually even questioning that they are putting in place in order to be useful for these people.
Yeah, I agree.
And they. So what I'm trying to say is that maybe we need to question what is the function of these language classes. And I'm maybe thinking in terms of empowering the migrant is maybe not helping us to see the whole picture.
I do agree with you. You see, perhaps we can understand this phenomenon in the case of migrants, two types of migrants, either highly skilled or low skilled migrant. In the case of highly skilled, what I have observed when I was in Finland and doing my fieldwork over there were lots of migrants who were working in Nokia, and they were not speaking a single line, single phrase of Finnish language. You know, they were all speaking in English. No one asked them to speak Finnish. No one asked them. So we have those kind of cases. Even in France also, now we have a kind of a very coveted type of card, which is for highly skilled migrant, which are, perhaps it was Nicolas Sarkozy who introduced it to. And so they were highly skilled English-speaking migrants, and they can speak in English and they can work in France, and there are people. I was in a social party with Hewlett Packard which is the computer enterprise. All were French, and others, they were all speaking in English over there. So I was very amazed. I thought that they have to speak the French. So there is a set of another migrant, and we have completely another conception of them. And with these migrants, as you have told, that the visibility to control them. So we have all those things we have with them. And the language is one of the tools to control them.
I want to say I agree with you. There's the danger.
Mic open?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Better now?
Yeah.
There's a danger of thinking of economy as being monolithic. And It is a case that I wouldn't have become a professor at the University of Chicago if I didn't learn English.
Mm.
And not just any kind of English, some form of English that is acceptable for the job. But there are people in the United States that can find jobs with just very little English for certain kinds of jobs. On the other hand, I think what your paper shows that if you are a migrant and you cannot do it within one facet of the economy, you can probably survive by doing it otherwise.
Mm.
If this person didn't speak, the people that you described didn't speak Urdu, they wouldn't have been able to survive. And what you show is they didn't go and find jobs with people that speak Arabic or people that speak Japanese because they would be unqualified. So language is really a tool, but it depends on where you find it useful, and it can be useful in one place and not in another. Which is why, you know, when I made my comment earlier, I wanted to make clear that Pierre Bourdieu makes sure that a language can have a capital.
It can be a
capital, but it depends on which market.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I just wanted to. I quite agree with Alfonso, surprisingly. And I think, like, for example, when you talk about invisible migrants, my first question: invisible to whom? Because it seems to me that they are pretty visible for, you know, a lot of people who matter for them, you know. So what I'm trying to say is that, and I agree with Alfonso, is that I think we need to rethink. You know, the ways in which we talk about language integration, whatever that means, participation in economy. When you say that, for example, what I understood by invisible people working in informal economy, but all the economists who work on informal economy have shown that informal economy is not separated from, you know, national economies. They are actually, it is really integrated. And as Alfonso says, actually, informal economy is never outside the purview of the state. It's very important to remember that. And a state can actually, it's pretty easy for a state to control this kind of informal economy. So what I'm trying to say is that I think you may be surprised by what you found, because you rely on the assumptions that are vehiculated, you know, by the state, and also that is reproduced in many many social linguistic work, to be frank, you know. And and for example, what you say is, for me, it's totally, I'm not surprised, because that's something that, and I'm glad that you are working on a setting like France, because usually people associate informal economy with the global south. And actually what you show is that, you know, similar dynamics actually apply, you know, and we need to not only document it, but we need to use these cases to challenge the narrative from the state, but also the narratives that are vehiculated in the scholars' work by economists and by some, you know, linguists as well, you know. And of course, there is something that Alfonso has also shown. There is a lot of money that is involved in all this, you know, apparatus of language teaching and stuff like that. So of course, they need to continue carrying the, you know, the narrative that language classes are really important. And by challenging the narrative, it doesn't mean that language classes are not important. What we are trying to say, wait a minute, it is a little bit more complicated than just acquiring language. And that's also what Leonie has shown, you know. And you know, I think your fieldwork prompts us to reopen the books, as Mufwene would say, and say, wait a minute, maybe, you know, we haven't thought it through, and we need to rethink, you know, all these things. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, you want to say something?
No, I do agree with you. As far as the invisibility thing is concerned, well, they are invisible in the sense that their language is not recognized. And if someone who doesn't, for example, in France, if there are lots of areas where they speak, where the street sellers, so they will only speak in Urdu or in Punjabi to sell something, for example. So as someone who speaks in Congolese or in other language, they won't come to them to buy, because they know that they speak only in Urdu. Because over here, with the passage of time, since 10 years, it has developed that, okay, this market is of Urdu one, this market is of Africa, you know. So, but all these markets, they are invisible to someone who speaks French, you know. And so the invisibility is in that sense. Even for myself, now I have a course which is called Sociophonetics in Urdu, and I send my students to record how Urdu is spoken by these people, okay, to show that how Urdu has different varieties. And they didn't know, because they were living also in those areas, and they told me that they were invisible to them unless they met them. And they told them that, yeah, we are students, and oh, you speak Urdu, you know. So because these students, they were scholarized in a French system, and they only speak French, so they didn't know about that. So they are invisible in a sense, and perhaps we have a lot of potentialities to tap this invisibility of people who hide their language also, because they can speak their own language, but they will speak only in the linguistic community. They won't speak to others. They will speak in French or in broken French, and they will say that no, they are French. For example, just to give last example, I worked with a Hmong community from China, and they told that they were always considered as Chinese, but they were Hmong, and everyone considered that they were Hmong, but they always spoke in French language. They never spoke in Hmong in the public, so they were invisible in that sense.
That's right. I know we are running out Thank of you. Time, but I yes. want to suggest that what you really want to say is invisible in the official discourse. When you put it that way, then it becomes it is no longer controversial to me.
And probably processes of invisibilization, I think, would be, because you would actually, you know, explain more things than just by saying invisible. Yeah, just a suggestion. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any question from the audience and from the online audience as well? You can either type your question in the chat box or speak, open your mic and speak if you want to interact with the speaker.
Start with a comment. I'm glad you like it. But my understanding of Urdu is that the market value of a language varies from one setting to another. And so what I see here is a case of miscalculation on the part of the migrants or immigrants, not really knowing the language regime of the destination, coming from a place where English is rated very high on the scale in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, and being surprised that English doesn't have, well, it has some status, an important one in some jobs for which the immigrants are not qualified,
yes.
But where they can find jobs, English has no value. And this is how they wind up becoming, as you characterize them, as invisible immigrants, because they cannot wait until they get papers. They have to earn a living, and they go and work for people that find their languages is a cost for that kind of, you know, practical response to the local situation.
Yes. I think that it's for most of the people, even when they get the paper also, they need basic, I'm talking about the French context, and they need basic skill in the French language so that they can do some work or they can understand how the system works. But in parallel, everything is working also. Without French and without English, I was invited some 10 years ago to teach French to a group of 15 construction workers. They were all Punjabis from India, and their boss was a Pakistani. And they were all speaking among themselves in Punjabi, and that was a huge construction site, huge chantier, and whole chantier near Airport Charles de Gaulle. And they were all happy, and they didn't want to learn French. I was just roaming, I was just going behind them, they'd come learn French, and it didn't work. So I just went away after 2 days.
Yeah. Alfonso has a question. Can you pass the mic? Okay. No, Manuela,
yes,
you have the mic.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting because of the construction, of course, industry. And I have just a question about the importance of subcontractors in this. And I was wondering if the case number 6, I'm sorry, I forgot the name, is the case of such a subcontractor, man, who at the beginning was just employed as a construction, you know, worker, and then maybe act as manpower entrepreneur, something like this, and that's why they are happy. And it's exactly the same case in the early 20th century
for
the Italians. So it's striking.
No, they are not subcontractor. He is not a subcontractor.
He is not.
He is happy because he has a stable job, and he doesn't speak French at all. He is working with a subcontractor.
Urdu speaking or
speaking Punjabi and Urdu.
Punjabi, exactly. So there is a man.
There is a man.
Recruiting.
The boss is the boss speaks Punjabi.
Right.
In fact, he mediates. Now his new boss is Moldovan nationality. And Moldovan, in fact, with him, he speaks a little bit French. He told me that now, because it has been now 6 years that he's here, IFTI. So now he speaks a little bit French, so he can understand a little bit. So he has developed this kind of competencies, but he has other co-workers who speak Urdu and Punjabi, so he's very fine with them.
Right, because this is a kind of job and where communication is very important, because in the construction sites, you have to coordinate yourself with other people in order to build a building with several, you know, tasks. Okay, so it's really interesting.
Alfonso?
Yeah, so thanks. This is great. And you know, while you were talking, and then I was having in mind also Leonie's talk, I do think we need to kind of maybe not fall into the trap that the kind of European liberal democratic state is putting us, preparing for us as sociolinguists, right? Because I do think we should not take for granted the idea, you know, language as key to, right? But rather think more about what is the whole apparatus which the liberal state puts in place around these specific, in your case, French language classes that your informants don't need, right? Because I think that if we put the question in terms of, you know, do they really need French to get to a job, we don't come very far. I do think that the point is that in Europe, all these language classes are anchored within a liberal democratic state. That means they come with welfare. They come with a whole set of money, but also they come with visibility. That means control.
okay? So getting into these classes is not necessarily about, you know, getting the language that you need to go and get a job. Entering these classes makes you visible to the disciplinary kind of dimension of the state. That's why if they die or go back to Pakistan, they don't get anything, because they are not channeled within this kind of, you know, apparatus of control. So I do think, and I also think we need to be careful to think about, you know, these people trump the state. You know, there is this this idea of legal illegalization. I mean, the state is aware of this, right? And I do think it's there. The whole system is put in place in a way to, in order to produce an army of workers like this, highly exploitable, people who make, you know, who earn 200 euros a month, right? Usually, you know, I don't know. So I do think that we really need to anchor, to really better understand what's happening here, to really maybe not to fall into the trap that the state is preparing for us, namely, you know, to fully normalize the idea that language is a key to work. And then you come to the conclusion, no, it's actually not, because they can use their own language. But these language classes, I think, are more complicated, are part of a much more complicated system which goes beyond the just, okay, what do they need to get a job? And I think that by kind of anchoring that, I just realized that by listening to you guys, by anchoring that within a more complicated, I think we also get to understand what is the value of these kind of language classes, both of doing it and also not doing it. I mean, in terms of from the perspective of the person that who attends. Yeah.
Completely agree with you. I got your point. The question is also that, well, I don't think that we are against the language classes. We cannot be against the language classes, but we see that it has very less utility. Perhaps it's not delivering the kind of thing which it should have delivered. The language classes which I have observed over there in this camp, there were around 15, 20 people who used to come every day. But some of them were interested and others were not interested. This brother, he was not interested. He told me that nothing enters into my brain. And this was the line which was told by many refugees, many asylum seekers, and perhaps in other countries also. So I do agree that language is not the tool for the stepping stone, and we have to see what kind of other tools which we can employ to give them more stability. It is a very complex issue, but we cannot also deny that language classes should not be given, you know.
Can you speak on the mic because people cannot hear you online? Yeah, thank you.
So maybe it's just my own kind of, I think that when you say language are maybe not so, they don't consider them so useful, these language classes. So at this point, I'm actually even questioning that they are put in place in order to be useful for these people.
Yeah, I agree.
And they, so what I'm trying to say is that maybe we need to question what is the function of these language classes. And I'm maybe thinking in terms of empowering the migrants is maybe not helping us to see the whole picture.
I do agree with you. You see, perhaps we can understand this phenomenon in the case of migrants, two types of migrants, either highly skilled or low skilled migrant. In the case of highly skilled, what I have observed when I was in Finland and doing my work over there were lots of migrants who were working in Nokia, and they were not speaking a single line, single phrase of Finnish language. You know, they were all speaking in English. No one asked them to speak Finnish. No one asked them. So we have those kind of cases. Even in France also, now we have a kind of a very coveted type of card, which is for highly skilled migrant, which perhaps it was Nicolas Sarkozy who introduced it to. And so they were highly skilled English-speaking migrants, and they can speak in English, and they can work in France, and they and there are people. I was in a social party with Hewlett Packard, which is the computer enterprise. All were all French, and others they were all speaking in English over there. So I was very amazed. I thought that they have to speak the French. So there is a set of another migrant, and we have completely another conception of them. And with these migrants, as you have told, that the visibility to control them, so we have all those things we have with them, and the language is one of the tools to control them.
I want to say I agree with you. There's the danger.
Open? Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Okay, better now?
Yeah.
Now, there's a danger of thinking of economy as being monolithic. And it is a case that I wouldn't have become a professor at the University of Chicago if I didn't learn English.
Mm.
And not just any kind of English, some form of English that is acceptable for the job. But there are people in the United States that can find jobs with just very little English for certain kinds of jobs. On the other hand, I think what your paper shows that if you are a migrant and you cannot do it within one facet of the economy, you can probably survive by doing it otherwise.
Hmm.
If this person didn't speak, the people that you described didn't speak Urdu, they wouldn't have been able to survive. And what you show is they didn't go and find jobs with people that speak Arabic or people that speak Japanese, because they would be unqualified. So language is really a tool, but it depends on where you find it useful, and it can be useful in one place and not in another. Which is why, you know, when I made my comment earlier, I wanted to make clear that Pierre Bourdieu made sure that a language can have a capital.
Capital,
but it depends on which market.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I just wanted to. I quite agree with Alfonso, surprisingly. And I think, like, for example, when you talk about invisible migrants, my first question: invisible to whom? Because it seems to me that they are pretty visible for, you know, a lot of people who matter for them, you know. So what I'm trying to say is that, and I agree with Alfonso, is that I think we need to rethink. You know, the ways in which we talk about language integration, whatever that means, participation in economy. When you say that, for example, what I understood by invisible people working in informal economy, but all the economists who work on informal economy have shown that informal economy is not separated from, you know, national economies. They are actually, it is really integrated. And as Alfonso says, actually, informal economy is never outside the purview of the state. It's very important to remember that. And a state can actually, it's pretty easy for a state to control this kind of informal economy. So what I'm trying to say is that I think you may be surprised by what you found, because you rely on the assumptions that are vehiculated, you know, by the state, and also that is reproduced in many many social linguistic work, to be frank, you know. And and for example, what you say is, for me, it's totally, I'm not surprised, because that's something that And I'm glad that you are working on a setting like France, because usually people associate informal economy with the global south. And actually what you show is that, you know, similar dynamics actually apply, you know, and we need to not only document it, but we need to use these cases to challenge the narrative from the state, but also the narratives that are vehiculated in scholars' work by economists and by some, you know, linguists as well, you know. And of course, there is something that Alfonso has also shown. There is a lot of money that is involved in all this, you know, apparatus of language teaching and stuff like that. So of course, they need to continue carrying the, you know, the narrative that language classes are really important. And by challenging the narrative, it doesn't mean that language classes are not important. What we are trying to say is, wait a minute, it is a little bit more complicated than just acquiring language. And that's also what Leonia showed, you know. And you know, I think your fieldwork prompts us to reopen the books, as Mufwene would say, and say, wait a minute, maybe, you know, we haven't thought it through, and we need to rethink, you know, all these things. Yeah. So, to say something?
No, I do agree with you. As far as the invisibility thing is concerned, well, they are invisible in the sense that their language is not recognized, you know, recognized. And if someone who doesn't, for example, in France, if there are lots of areas where they speak, where the street sellers, so they will only speak in Urdu or in Punjabi to sell something, for example. So someone who speaks in Congolese or in another language, they won't come to them to buy, because they know that they speak only in Urdu, because it has... Because over here, with the passage of time, since 10 years, it has developed that, okay, this market is of Urdu one, this market is of Africa, you know. So, but all these markets, they are invisible to someone who speaks French, you know. And so the invisibility is in that sense. Even for myself, now I have a course which is called Sociophonetics of in Urdu, and I send my students to record how Urdu is spoken by these people, okay, to show that how Urdu has different varieties. And they didn't know, because they were living also in those areas, and they told me that they were invisible to them unless they met them, and they told them that, yeah, we are students, and oh, you speak Urdu, you know. So because these students, they were scholarized in a French system, and they only speak French, so they didn't know about that. So they are invisible in a sense, and perhaps we have a lot of potentialities to tap this invisibility of people who hide their language also, because they can speak their own language, but they will speak only in the linguistic community. They won't speak to others. They will speak in French or in broken French, and they will say that no, they are French. For example, just to give last example, I work with a Hmong community from China. And they told that they were always considered as Chinese, but they were Hmong. And everyone considered that they were Hmong, but they always spoke in French language. They never spoke in Hmong in the public. So they were invisible in that sense.
I know we are running out Thank of you. Time, but I yes. want to suggest that what you really want to say is invisible in the official discourse. When you put it that way, then it becomes, it is no longer controversial.
And probably processes of invisibilization, I think, would be, because you would actually, you know, explain more things than just by saying invisible. Yeah, just a suggestion. Okay, thank you.